for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Last week, 4,000 U.S. Marines initiated their largest operation since the 2004 battle in Iraq for Fallujah. The hope is to counter a growing Taliban insurgency. Joining me to talk about the mission, its objectives, and the overall situation in Afghanistan, from Afghanistan is Seth Jones. He's a political scientist at RAND and professor at Georgetown University. Here in the studio, John Nagel. He's with the Center for New American Security and a recent appointee to the Defense Policy Board. And Washington Post reporter Greg Jaffe. And throughout the hour, we'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Before we begin our conversation with our guests here in the studio and Seth Jones, joining us now from Kabul, Afghanistan, is Nancy Youssef. She's Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Good morning to you, Nancy. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane.
Nancy, what can you tell us about the attack on NATO soldiers in northern Afghanistan today?
Well, this happened earlier today. This was a convoy traveling through northern Afghanistan, which historically has been the safest part of Afghanistan. It's an area that's generally controlled by German forces, but right before we went on the air, I spoke to Colonel Gregory Julian, who's the spokesman here, and he tells me that the four soldiers were, in fact, U.S. soldiers killed. They're not saying what their mission was up there. There are soldiers based there who are embedded trainers for the police and the Army. There are logisticians there, and they're now in the process of notifying the families. It's troubling because, again, that area of Afghanistan has been the safest part, and it marks a deadly week for U.S. forces in Afghanistan, seven in about a week's time.
Nancy, there are also reports of an attack near the gates of Kandahar airfield. What can you tell us about that?
That's right. That was at the first gate as you come into Kandahar, which is in southern Afghanistan. Kandahar has been one of the most troublesome provinces of this country. It's outside a main NATO base there. It killed two civilians and wounded 14 others. And so, again, another troubling sign of an uptick in violence in that part of the country. And it's, by the way, it's an area that neighbors Helmand Province, which is where the Marine operation is taking place.
Are the Taliban putting up more resistance than was expected?
No, I think, in fact, they're putting up less resistance. When I talked to U.S. military officials at the start of this operation, the anticipation was that there'd be a severe uptick in violence, followed by a drop as they move through district by district. And in fact, that hasn't happened. Instead, they're finding evidence that the Taliban have fled, weapons left behind, drugs left behind. I spoke to the defense ministry here in Kabul today. They believe that the Taliban are fleeing north of Helmand and also east into Farah province. So all indications are that they're fleeing. When you talk to people here, there's a feeling that, or at least a perception that this operation is temporary, despite the message that the forces are going to stay and make sure that areas are safe before they hand it over to their Afghan counterparts. But the perception is that this is temporary, and I think the Taliban are operating under that perception as well.
Now, what kinds of instructions are being given to U.S. soldiers as the insurgents drop their weapons and flee into nearby villages?
Well, the real emphasis here is trying to change the relationship between U.S. forces and the Afghan population. And so the effort has been towards reaching out to locals and elders in the districts and places that haven't seen stable security in years and saying that we are here. The Taliban have fled, but we're going to stay, and we're not going to leave until the security situation here is stabilized. And so I think that's been the heart of the message that U.S. forces are operating under.
Now, earlier, I gather last week, a U.S. soldier was missing in eastern Afghanistan. There had been statements to the effect that he might have been kidnapped. An Islamic website this morning confirms the kidnap of the U.S. soldier in Afghanistan. This just came across the wire, Nancy.
Yes. You know, the U.S. military response here has been incredulous to that incident. It's the first time a U.S. soldier has been captured in Afghanistan, and what's so disturbing to officials here is that they believe the soldier walked off the base, that this wasn't an incident where Taliban or insurgent forces ran through the base and took over. They believe that the soldier walked off and left his gun behind. And so they're just gobsmacked about the circumstances of this kidnapping. They also believe that this kidnapping happened in Pastika, where he was based, and that he was taken within hours of his walking off base. They don't have any evidence of this, by the way. There's no video or anything showing him walk off. They're basing it on the little evidence that they have when he didn't show up for his morning formation.
And Nancy, what is the reaction there to comments that the U.S. is not going to be sending any more troops?
Yes, after General Jones's quotes appeared in the Washington Post and also in an interview he gave with McClatchy that no U.S. forces, additional U.S. forces would be coming, I can tell you the commanders that I spoke to in Kabul were frustrated. I think there was a feeling that, why are we doing the 60-day assessment, which they're in the middle of doing, if the decision has already been made about how many forces will be here? I was on the military base here in Kabul, and people were coming up to me volunteering their frustration that this decision has already been made. That said, I think people were operating under the reality that the number of forces were never going to be as many as they wanted, and that their job is to somehow replicate some of the successes and the benefits of the surge without that key element of having enough forces to have multiple, if you will, surge operations going on in Afghanistan. And so what you're seeing in Helmand is the first major offensive, and I think the hope is that if they're able to stabilize Helmand, that they can then move forces and move the operation into other unstable parts of Afghanistan.
Is the belief that the offensive is going to help establish security ahead of the August 20th elections?
Yes, and that's a key part of it. If it goes according to plan, then these forces will be able to clear the Helmand River Valley and start to see residents come back and take the boards down in front of their businesses and return to their communities in time for the election. And that's not intended to benefit Hamid Karzai, but to really benefit the Afghans and let them vote. Because one of the biggest concerns coming up on this election is that too many Afghans won't feel safe to go to the ballot boxes, to go to the voting centers and cast their vote. And so this is an effort in one of the most troubled parts of Afghanistan to give residents an opportunity to vote. The hope is that it benefits all the candidates when residents are given an opportunity to vote, and it will legitimize the election process, which I think the American officials believe is a key part of that process. It must be seen as legitimate. And one way to do that is to make sure as many people can vote as possible without the threat of the Taliban pressuring them to vote for one person or another or to not vote at all.
And what's been the reaction of the Afghan civilians? Have they welcomed U.S. troops?
You know, it's interesting in Helmand Province, the relationship generally in Afghanistan between the U.S. and the Afghan civilians is a little strained right now. But in Helmand province, they really welcome the American presence. So before the Marines arrived, there were, and actually they're still there, 8,000 British troops, but there's been a real tense relationship between the British forces and the residents of Helmand. You'll repeatedly hear residents of Helmand say, why can't 8,000 British troops deal with the Taliban threat? And there's a hope that this influx of U.S. forces will finally put this problem to rest for them. And so I think they are welcome. That said, they emphasize how the Marines interact with them will shape that relationship, that if they see an uptick in civilian casualties, if they feel that the Marines don't respect them and their families, that this will lead to a long-term problem. They're really emphasizing, we want these American forces here, and we want them to treat us and our civilians here with respect. So overall, I think they're hopeful that the U.S. Marines will be able to finally put a stop to this Taliban problem, which has all but consumed districts in Helmand province for 5 years now.
One last question, Nancy. Briefly, are you suggesting that the U.S. soldier simply walked off the base and into the hands of his Afghan captors?
Well, what U.S. officials here believe, based on what was left behind, is that he did indeed walk off. Now, whether he walked in his captor's hands, I don't think anybody knows that. They don't know how he got into his captor's hands. But there is a feeling here, based on the very little that they know, that he walked off. It's very rare for any soldier to have any reason to leave base on his own in Afghanistan or Iraq. And every evidence that they have suggests that that's in fact what happened. And so they're really befuddled here by the circumstances that led to his capture. Now, how exactly he was captured, I don't think anyone here knows.
All right. Yet. Thank you, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers. Welcome back. We'll turn now to our three other guests. Seth Jones, he is joining us from Afghanistan. He's a RAND political scientist, Georgetown University professor, and author of In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan. John Noggle is president of the Center for New American Security. He's a retired Army officer and author of Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife. Greg Jaffe is a reporter for The Washington Post. He has a book coming out in October titled The Fourth Star, Four Generals and the Epic Struggle for the Future of the United States Army. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Seth, if I could turn to you first. I gather you were supposed to be back in the States this week. Tell us why you were asked to stay.
Well, I'm just here looking at the general security situation in Afghanistan. There's a 60-day assessment going on, so there's a lot of work that the U.S. is doing in looking at the security situation and the strategy to move forward.
Now, I know that General McChrystal, the new overall commander in Afghanistan, has undertaken this 60-day review. What is the mission in Afghanistan?
Well, I think the primary mission is to protect the Afghan population. There has been a fundamental change, I would say, over the last couple of weeks since General McChrystal has focused predominantly on the Afghanistan front to put front and center the protection of the Afghan population, not of U.S. forces, not of other coalition forces, not even of Afghan forces, but to find ways to use American, other coalition, and Afghan forces to protect Afghans. And when you look at public opinion polls from the Asia Foundation and other organizations, for example, especially in rural areas of Afghanistan, south, west, and east, many Afghans do feel insecure. So I think the focus now of U.S. strategy is increasingly on protecting the Afghan population, which is really a core tenet of most counterinsurgency operations.
John Nuckel, do we know what the overall strength of forces will ultimately be in Afghanistan?
We don't, Diane, and that's one of the things that this 60-day review that General McChrystal is conducting and Seth is helping with will try to determine. We know that based on historical counterinsurgency campaigns, the total number of troops is best expressed as a ratio in regard to the overall population. Afghanistan has a population of 30 million people. That would require about 600,000 troops total to protect them. Most of those should be Afghan troops. One of the primary questions that I think General McChrystal's review is going to determine is whether the Afghan army, currently at 80,000, planned to grow to 135,000, whether that growth is enough. Many people, myself included, think that the Afghan army will have to be 250,000 in order to protect the Afghan people, to secure Afghanistan against the Taliban, and to prevent instability throughout the region.
Greg Jaffe, what are military officials telling you privately about the force numbers needed for Afghanistan?
You know, I think there's a general feeling that there needs to be more, particularly if you're going to secure population areas. Part of the problem in Afghanistan is the roads are so terrible. So it takes units forever to move short distances. You know, some sectors are 30 miles long, but it'll take 4 hours to transit that sector. So it does require more troops, arguably, than an Iraq situation where you had a fairly dense population with a fairly decent road network. Here it's much more dispersed.
And why so few Afghan soldiers?
You know, I think it's partially that you don't have a lot to work with in Afghanistan. You know, you have a very small number of literate people, so it takes a while to find people, to train people. That said, I think the Afghan troops are critical, and I almost feel like it's a mistake to have U.S. troops operating without Afghan troops. So it might be a mistake to add more U.S. troops until you've got more Afghan troops, because it creates so much resentment when U.S. troops go into an area and search Afghan houses. It's much less with Afghan soldiers.
John Nagel.
And if I can just point out that although we started building the Afghan army before we started building the Iraqi army, the Iraqi army is now 4 times larger than the Afghan army is, and that's why we're able increasingly in Iraq to hand over responsibility to our Iraqi counterparts. We're not going to be able to do that in Afghanistan until we decide to build a big enough Afghan army.
Does this whole operation officially make the war in Afghanistan President Obama's war?
I think really the replacement of General McKiernan with General McChrystal was a very clear determination by President Obama that he is assuming responsibility for this war, that he is determined to succeed in this war. He now has his own team conducting operations, making decisions, and his team is committed, I believe, to doing what's necessary to succeed here.
Seth Jones.
Yeah, I just wanted to support John's comment. I think this is President Obama's war now. He's made a conscious decision to focus U.S. efforts both on the Afghanistan and Pakistan front. But I wanted to come in on one issue that both Greg and John mentioned, and that is numbers of forces. I think there is sometimes a misconception within Washington, both in the policy communities and within the government, to focus primarily on national forces. And if you look at Afghanistan's history, its most stable periods, for example, during the Zahir Shah period between 1933 and 1973, a lot of stability happened among local tribal forces at the village level. I would say there's a lot there's a lot of interest among a range of tribes, sub-tribes, and clans to protect their own areas in Afghanistan. This does not mean that the numbers of U.S. forces have to be really significant, or necessarily that the numbers of Afghan national army and police forces have to be exorbitant. I think in addition to those numbers, one has to really look at leveraging a range of local actors who have already indicated in a range of places they're willing to turn against the Taliban.
You know, it's very interesting. There was a Washington Post editorial on Friday titled, "Can Commanders in Afghanistan Tell the President the Truth About Troop Shortages?" And you know, you got to wonder, with a population as large as that in Afghanistan, how much of a difference can this number of U.S. troops make when you've even got Marine Brigadier General Lawrence Nicholson hinting he could use thousands more troops? John Nagle.
He also asked for thousands more Afghan troops. And I agree with Seth's point. I think that tribal militias offer some real potential in Afghanistan. What we're doing in Afghanistan now that we haven't done before is we're implementing classic clear, hold, build counterinsurgency strategies. Previously, we've cleared and left, and the Taliban has simply returned from the mountains and intimidated the
local
population.
Okay, but how does this work? Give me specifics.
So in southern Helmand right now, we have 4,000 Marines setting up local security stations in and around the villages. And as long as they're there, they're able to keep the Taliban from reinfiltrating, from intimidating the population. They're able to create oil spots of security. The problem is they don't have any Afghan forces, whether militias or Afghan army or police, to hand off to. So they're stuck.
So if they leave there, you've got the same situation.
All of the gains are lost again.
Greg Jaffe, do you agree?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. No, it's exactly right. It's the only way to do it. But you know, there's a limit that you can cover with what they've got, and to a certain extent, even with the oil spots, they're moving from one oil spot to another, and so your ability to consolidate and control the entire city, I think, is difficult.
Seth Jones, this sounds like an almost impossible situation.
No, I actually don't think it is impossible, because I think when one looks very closely at Helmand, that you see a range of Barakzai tribes, Nurzai tribes, that are interested in cooperating. I think what the U.S. has not done well enough, and the British, for that matter, have not done well enough, is taking advantage of local tribes and sub-tribes who do want to turn against the Taliban. They're tired of Taliban forces moving into their villages. And so the key question is, in addition to getting Afghan National Army to partner with Marine forces operating in Helmand, is if they can reach out to help hold areas with Barakzai, Nurzai, Alazai, and other tribes who have showed a willingness to do that. I think if that's done, then this thing can turn sooner rather than later.
John.
I agree with Seth that the tribal militias offer a great opportunity. We managed to turn a number of tribes in El Anbar province first and then in Baghdad with the Sons of Iraq. And what Seth is describing is sort of a Sons of Afghanistan program where the local militias assume responsibility for their own village
now,
security.
Does that mean that the U.S. pays those individuals in order to become that kind of turned force?
Absolutely, and it's a great investment. It's a much we get a much higher return on investment as long as we screen them properly than we do on sending additional American troops, who are far, far more expensive.
But does that mean paying them for the long term?
I'm afraid it does. It also means we're going to need American advisors embedded with them for the long term. So this is not a short-term problem.
Greg.
But it's much cheaper to pay soldiers than, or to pay Afghans than to have U.S. forces over there. It's an incredibly good investment.
But Greg, you wrote yesterday about a possible link between Iraq violence and U.S. troop withdrawal. So how could the same be prevented in Afghanistan? Do you pay them forever?
Well, I think, you know, ultimately paying them for an extended period of time is cheaper than keeping large numbers of U.S. soldiers over there. It's far, far cheaper. You know, when we lose soldiers, when we lose equipment, it's incredibly expensive. That said, I mean, I think Seth's right. I think in the near term, you can make lots of progress. The Taliban are unpopular in a way that the Iraqi insurgents weren't. For a long time, the Iraqi insurgents were seen as the noble resistance. The Taliban are seen as outsiders. So they're relatively easy to push out of urban areas. The hard part is, I think the Taliban are a much smarter and more disciplined force than the Iraqi insurgents. They will wait in the countryside. They will wait for us to move. And as soon as we leave an area, they move right back in. Mm. They're much savvier. 30 years of on-the-job training, I guess.
Seth, what about the Afghan-Pakistan hostilities? To what extent have they gotten in the way of progress for U.S. forces?
Well, I think the fact that virtually every major insurgent group, from the Taliban, which operates in southern Afghanistan, the Haqqani Network, which operates in North Waziristan and the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan, to a range of other groups, has its command and control structure in Pakistan. Virtually every major group, including the Taliban, which is fighting against the Marines in Helmand Province, can bring weapons and fighters, can move drugs out of Afghanistan. They use that Afghan-Pakistani border to supplement virtually every activity that they're involved in. So it really is a fundamental and key strategic area. And for that matter, the Taliban's major inner shura is actually located in Pakistan. Individuals like Mullah Omar, Mullah Berader, which make up the inner shura, do their strategy and operational planning from the Pakistani side of the border. So it is fundamental. It's fundamental, and it is clearly impacting U.S. Marine operations in Helmand.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. First, let's go to Hickory, North Carolina. Good morning, Kurt. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I had a question. Kind of to everyone. It seems like when we move in places, you know, she spoke of, you know, them fleeing away. You know, what actually are we helping out if they're just going to go to another place and all we're going to have to do is end up going to another country and trying to get them out of there? It seems like, you know, it happened in Iraq and then we went to Afghanistan and we're doing it again. And, you know, I'm a soldier and, you know, I'm probably going to be in Afghanistan soon. And I'm just trying to figure out why I'm doing what I'm doing and, you know, if I'm actually helping.
Seth.
Well, the British term for this is called mowing the grass. So the issue is if we cannot hold territory, then this is a substantive problem. If, as John noted earlier, there's an oil spot strategy, if you can hold a given territory, the Marines are operating in a range of districts like Garmsur and Helmand. If they can actually hold these districts and move outward, then they can track people down who have fled to other areas like Farah and Kandahar provinces. So the key question, though, is whether Marine and other U.S. and coalition forces can hold territory. If they can't, then it is mowing the grass, and it does get back to the exact problem that the caller identified.
John.
Kurt, thanks for your service. When we were fighting in Iraq with not enough forces, we called it squeezing the balloon. We'd attack in one place, we'd clear an area of insurgents, and they'd go somewhere else. Until we were able, with the surge, to hold some territory ourselves, until we were able to develop an Iraqi security force and Iraqi tribal militias that could hold what we cleared, we just, no matter how many times we squeezed the balloon, it bulged out somewhere else. We're working hard toward having enough forces to hold what we've cleared. The work Seth Jones is talking about, building some tribal militias inside Afghanistan, is incredibly important in that. But until we get more forces on the ground, we're now practicing the right strategy, but we have to resource it appropriately, and I'm afraid we haven't done that yet.
Kurt, thanks for your service and for your call. Let's go now to Roy in Rochester, New York. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was trying to figure out more how to frame this. I know that I'm sure the Marines and the military are more realists about this, but I'm wondering what happens, what exactly you'd say the Taliban's policies about keeping prisoners are. I look at past accounts in Ghost Wars by Steve Call, who's been on this show, that the Russian 40th Army didn't get many prisoners back. What happens if Americans start going away in the ways that soldiers died in past Afghan wars?
John Nuckel.
Roy, we're very fortunate that so far we have not had very many American soldiers taken prisoner. This appears to me to be a very unusual case. We did lose some prisoners in Iraq, but again, a very small number. So Steve Cole's book is a good thing to look at, but the American tactics are different. The American force protection measures are different, and I very much hope that the case of this one missing soldier is a one-off case, and this is not a problem we're going to have to deal with very much. Everyone is horrible.
John Nuckel, he's president of the Center for New American Security, recently named to the Defense Policy Board by Defense Secretary Robert Gates. Short break and more of your calls, your email when we return. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org, by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A Nigerian-born author explores the ties that bind men and women, children and parents, Africa and the U.S. She presents her latest collection of stories set in Nigeria and the U.S. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We'll go right back to the phones. Let's go now to Ted in New Haven, Connecticut. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Dan. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I'll make a comment real fast. Briefly, since the Gulf War in 1990, over 1 million Iraqi children have died. That's forgetting Afghanistan and Pakistan. How can these people on your show blithely talk about invading another country when we have slaughtered and so many innocent people? This is the most bizarre thing I've ever heard. And these people aren't alone. It's the entire national media, as you know. We are the most murderous country on earth, just to keep our military-industrial complex going.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. He also wanted to mention the new front in Pakistan, John Nagel.
Mm-hmm. Let me start, if I can. I fought in Desert Storm. There have been many civilian casualties in Iraq, in particular in between Desert Storm and the invasion of Iraq in 2003 as a result of the sanctions, the worldwide sanctions. The United Nations imposed sanctions on Iraq for failing to declare its weapons of mass destruction program and failing to comply with UN resolutions. So I think the United States, although it makes mistakes in general, it intervenes for the security of the American people and to do good in the world. And
now,
I'm
you're not citing weapons of mass destruction as a reason for going into Iraq.
In between Desert Storm and the 2003 invasion, there were a number of UN resolutions calling on Saddam Hussein to declare his weapons of mass destruction program and allow UN inspectors to determine whether they existed or not. Saddam admitted recently, in recently reported diary
that he
accounts,
had not,
but that he wished that he had in fact allowed the inspectors to come in and see that he had none. So his decisions, he actually destroyed his programs after Desert Storm, but did not admit that he had done so publicly out of fear for Iran, actually, interestingly, against whom he'd fought a horrible 8-year war in the 1980s. So all that said, The chances for success in Afghanistan and Pakistan have, I think, gone up dramatically as a result of actions by the Pakistani government in recent months, which is now finally starting to take its own war against the Taliban seriously. It's conducted a number of counterinsurgency campaigns, not very sophisticated campaigns. It's doing a great job of clearing, not a very good job of holding and building in the aftermath.
Greg Jaffe.
I think eastern Afghanistan is an interesting sort of case study. We've had troops there for quite a while, and they've actually made a fair amount of progress in terms of driving the Taliban out of the cities and up into the mountains. The problem is it's still very easy for those folks, those Taliban, to move across the border into Pakistan. They can get across the border and back before U.S. troops can even get up into the mountainous areas. So you're sort of bailing out a leaking boat in some ways in that respect. And despite the fact that the Pakistanis are doing better, and I was up on the border a few weeks ago and you could hear the Pakistani military offensive in the distance. You could see the bombs going off and hear them. The Pakistani border guards are terrified. You know, they're prisoners in these tiny little forts. And they go get their water on the Afghan side of the border because they know if they go into the little village on the Pakistani side of the border, the Taliban will cut their heads off, as they say. So, you know, yes, Pakistan's doing much better. They have a long, long way to go.
Seth, what would you comment in regard to Pakistan, its assistance in this effort to rid the Taliban?
Well, Pakistan has played really both sides of the coin. They have been extremely helpful in hunting down a range of senior al-Qaeda operatives. They helped capture Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Abu Faraj al-Libi, Ramzi bin al-Shib. So they've been extraordinarily helpful. Hundreds, if not thousands, of Pakistani soldiers have died fighting a range of militants in the federal-administered tribal areas of Pakistan and the Northwest Frontier Province. At the same time, though, the U.S. And other coalition forces have compiled evidence that elements of Pakistan's intelligence and paramilitary frontier corps over the past several years have provided some assistance to the Taliban and have provided some assistance to the Haqqani network. So they clearly have played both sides of this front, but they have been, in some cases, quite helpful, really very helpful to the United States. I wanted to make one other comment on the caller, and that is, I think it's very important to understand that levels of support for the United States early on in 2001, 2, 3, 4 were upwards of 70%. And you have to remember the Taliban regime that came before U.S. invasion of Afghanistan was ruthless. It banned virtually all forms of entertainment, including kite flying. Women not far from where I'm standing right now were executed in the soccer stadium. They banned women from work. I mean, it was one of the most ruthless regimes of the modern era. So this is why Afghans en masse have supported U.S. assistance in getting rid of that regime. So we need to see the Afghan situation in that context.
Here's an email from James, who's in Copenhagen, Denmark. He says, we are wasting national treasure, actually the money of our Chinese bankers, on a futile effort in an unconstitutional, undeclared war. This close to the 4th of July, we need to be reminded that our founding fathers warned us against involvement in foreign wars. No great power in history has succeeded in Afghanistan, and the U.S. will not either. John Nagel.
I pretty profoundly disagree with the caller. The war effort in Afghanistan is pretty high on the list of just wars conducted by the United States or by any country. It was from this country that attacks were planned and executed that killed 3,000 of our own citizens. Seth has just talked about the brutality of the Taliban regime. That regime was given the opportunity to hand over Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda to us and told if it did not do so, it would face consequences. It chose not to do so, and of course, we toppled that government. I can point to a number of counterinsurgency campaigns that have succeeded through history. In fact, insurgents succeed only about 40% of the time. Afghanistan is, in fact, was in the 1970s a pretty successful country. It was a country that had a balance of trade surplus, something the United States does not currently have, and it is, I believe, a country that can do that again. But it's going to take a lot of help from us and from our international partners to defeat the scourge of the Taliban and to build the government, the security forces that Afghanistan needs to secure itself over the long haul.
Greg Jaffe.
I agree with John completely. The one thing I will say that makes Afghanistan different from other wars like Iraq is that the infrastructure challenges are just massive. You talk about wanting to get rid of poppy, which is a huge issue in Helmand where the Marines are now. And it's not just about giving seeds to farmers. It's about building roads. It's about getting electricity in so that they can have refrigeration systems. There's this massive supply chain effort in a country that has just been completely flattened by decades of war. And it's really going to take a long, sustained commitment to do nation building there. And I worry, just as an observer, that at times we kid ourselves about how hard it's going to be to rebuild this country and how little there is there.
Here's an email from Marilyn in Arvada, Colorado. She says, when Bush first attacked Afghanistan, he promised we would stay and build the country and would show that America would keep its commitment. He even got my support as a liberal progressive, given all his emphasis on women's rights and so on. Can your panel tell us where we might be now if we had stayed in Afghanistan then and kept our promise to the Afghan people in late 2001? Are we not now just trying to recapture that basic premise? And is it too late? Seth Jones.
Well, I think that in my personal view, it was a mistake to decrease U.S. resources to Afghanistan starting in about 2002. By 2003 and 2004, Afghanistan was one of the least funded nation-building operations since World War II on a per capita level. So where would it be now? Hard to tell. A lot would depend on the strategy that was used. But we're at where we're at right now. So I don't think the situation is lost. And I would simply note that Afghanistan historically has been stable. It was stable not that long ago, about 35 years ago, mid-70s, was right before the Soviet invasion. It was probably the last notable point where the country was stable. And one has to look, I think, very carefully at the criteria and the factors that led to stability in Afghanistan. So the key lesson for me is that Afghans historically have been able to stabilize their country. And so the U.S. role and the coalition role in this country has to be to find ways for Afghans to stabilize their country, not to do it for them, because that's the only recipe that has worked in this country.
But what about the rebuilding process? Do you see America staying there for the years it will take to rebuild what was already a very difficult situation, Seth?
Well, the question is, what's the bar that you want to set? Most Afghans, when you visit rural areas, don't ask for a lot. What they're generally asking for is basic development assistance, might be electricity, water, a well, a road so that they can get assistance, farm products to a market. I saw some of the road construction in Kunar province that allowed a range of different vegetables to get to the market in Assadabad. I think there could be a 5 to 10 year commitment to provide. You're not talking about massive levels of assistance, but enough assistance that would get Afghanistan to a reachable benchmark like Bangladesh. I mean, I think the issue is not to set one's expectations to make Afghanistan something that it's not, but to set reasonable expectations. And again, in my visits into rural Afghanistan, most Afghans aren't asking for a lot. They're asking for some security and some very basic development assistance.
Greg Jaffe.
And I think that's achievable.
Yeah, I think Seth's right. I mean, Bangladesh may be the kind of right aim point to shoot for. And Afghans don't need to do a lot to make a huge difference. But doing a little requires a lot of effort because it's such an isolated place and the terrain is so awful. And Afghans' expectations tend to be a movable thing. You know, you give them a little and they know, thanks to the invasion and satellite TV, they know how the rest of the world is living. So, you know, it tends to be a movable bar. You give them a little and they want a little more. They look across the border in Pakistan and they know that people there are living far better than they are.
Let's go to Bill in Green, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have a question and a comment. My question is, my son is an intelligence officer stationed at Operating Base Gardez. How much is the Army involved in the latest offensive? You read in the papers that it's primarily a Marine operation, but we haven't heard from him for some time, obviously have some concern. And my comment is that regardless of how people feel about these wars, there are young men, women and men fighting these that believe they're defending our country. And they're not part of the military-industrial complex. They're just trying to do a job to have us celebrate the 4th of July and holidays like that.
Indeed, Bill. Thank you so much. And for your son's service, I hope he stays safe. At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Seth, can you comment on his son's base?
Well, the press has covered the Marine offensive in Helmand province, which is largely a Marine effort. In Gardez and in what's called Regional Command East, where his son is operating, including in Gardez, the Army is conducting a range of operations, just haven't been the focus of media attention. And Gardez is quite important because it does sit near the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. There are a whole range of networks, especially the Haqqani network, which is been involved in some of the more high-profile suicide attacks in Afghanistan, including in Kabul, operates from that general area. So Army is conducting a range of operations in that area, just is not getting the media attention that's getting in Helmand.
John Nagel, do we know how high the morale is among the Taliban?
The Taliban has had a tough 6 months. The new U.S. administration, the Obama administration, has demonstrated increased resolve. It has actually increased the drone strikes inside Afghanistan and inside Pakistan. It has dramatically increased the American commitment to this war. And if you're the Taliban, you're a little bit on the run right now. So the offensives we're seeing, the increased emphasis on a new counterinsurgency strategy that holds and builds as well as clears, has to concern them greatly.
But don't these drone strikes also take a civilian toll? And isn't that precisely what the Afghan people have said? Don't do that to us, Greg.
Yeah, the Afghans are very, very upset by the airstrikes. Even in provinces where you haven't had mass casualties, you hear people complain about them vociferously. And I think the new strategy, as Seth has pointed out, and John as well, is focused on getting us away from those airstrikes. And one of the advantages of having more troops on the ground is that you should use fewer airstrikes. You know, you can resolve a situation with a rifle instead of a 1,000-pound bomb dropped from the sky.
And then you come full circle to the question of, are there enough troops there to do the job that the U.S. has set out to do, Greg?
Right. No, that's the question, and I think you don't know till you know. We'll see how this does and if it requires more or not. The hope is, or I guess my concern, given what we've seen in the press, is whether the Obama administration is open to hearing a fair and honest accounting from the military leaders on the ground, or whether the answer's been prejudged and the military officers kind of know what they're supposed to say.
John Nagle.
My sense is that we do need more boots on the ground, but we don't have that many to give. The Army is under severe strain. We remain very committed to the drawdown in Iraq, but it's going to take a while for the Army to recover from the surge there. So the long-term answer has to be more reliance on Afghans to secure Afghanistan.
Seth Jones, 5 seconds, please.
I think John is right. If we rely on more Afghans, we do actually have enough forces on the ground, I think.
Seth Jones, RAND political scientist, author of In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan. John Nagle is president of the Center for New American Security. He was recently named to the Defense Policy Board by Defense Secretary Robert Gates, and Greg Jaffe, reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you so much. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.